Chapter 1. Igneous. How can you not be captivated by the idea of making wine from the roiling, boiling, sulfurous, belching belly of the earth? I am obsessed with these igneous soils, especially those born of the volcano. And more often than not, I find I am drawn to wines that come from them. At first, this seemed like an accident, but then, as I delved deeper into the taste similarities, I began to wonder if it was so very random. Volcanic wines have a very specific texture. Sometimes it's an ashiness. Sometimes it's an edge, or what terroir expert Pedro Parra would call a nervous sensation. These igneous soils have a parentage of magma, the molten, fiery, subterranean blood of the earth. But how the magma manifests itself, whether it stays beneath the surface or whether the lava bursts out of a volcano's crater, informs the kind of rock it becomes. The resulting stone is either intrusive rock or extrusive rock, fraternal twins of the same parent, but with different gestational conditions. Intrusive rocks means that they are formed inside the earth under pressure and heat. This includes the boulders that the volcano purges, as well as the heated, cooled, and pressurized earth that becomes gabbro and granite. Extrusive rocks come from lava flows that cool and harden outside the womb on the earth's surface. The lava takes centuries to degrade and become arable soil. The rocks that are formed in this process include rhyolite, pumice, tuff, scoria, volcanic ash, and, most importantly, basalt. Basalt. The extrusive, iron-rich basalt is made when hot lava flow cools. The best examples are found on islands. Basalt is complicated. It first occurred to me that it was one of the most intriguing soils when I was visiting the Canary Islands, one of the most profound spots of volcanic activity in the world. Just off the North African coast, belonging to Spain, almost all of these islands have a wine history. Some more volcanic than others. Lanzarote and one section of La Palma have black, ashen soils that squeak as if walking on ebony snow. To think that a vine could squiggle down underneath to find rock and mineral in a soil almost absent of clay seemed death-defying. All I could think of with certain wines I had from there was basalt, straight from the earth's iron core to the glass. Shortly after that fabulous trip, I traveled to Washington State to give a talk on terroir at Whitman College. Lo and behold, my host, Kevin Pogue, was a basalt specialist. The forces were sending basalt messages to me. During the downtime, Professor Pogue ferried me around to see some of the local Walla Walla basalt-derived soils of the Columbia Basin. I shared with him my newfound passion and asked him how it was possible that basalt was so ignored in the wine world. He said that, for one, not a whole lot of wine areas have vines planted on it, and yes, basalt was a little miracle. Basalt can hoard magic inside its form. There's even some research being done about soil amelioration with basalt dust and exploiting its water-holding capacity, especially vital when so many vineyards around the world are facing drought conditions due to climate change. The professor kneeled down, picked up a black rock, and set me straight. The rocks he showed me are assets to any cooler vineyard, radiating warmth, promoting ripening. Because lava cools quickly, extrusive rocks such as basalt are fine-grained, but it is when the hard material breaks down into well-drained soil that the impact on taste can start. Battered by rain and heat, the rocks weather into cold, dark, and oftentimes red soil. Why red? Iron. Think about a nail exposed to water. It's the same thing. Coming from the earth's core, these stones were filled with iron, which, whether in soil or man, impacts energy. We know that too little iron in our blood leads to anemia and loss of power. Too much of it beats a path to toxicity. Just the right amount turns you into Popeye. In the vine, iron is also necessary. It is an essential nutrient to photosynthesis and aids chemical reactions. Pogue noted that iron has also been proven to affect the composition and concentration of the phenolic compounds responsible for aroma and flavor. But, he said to me, speaking like a scientist, What we don't know is how these elements affect smell and taste in wine. Whether true or imagined, I sense a particular soil, a rusty, edgy ash with almost oxidized acidity in some of my favorite basalt-grown wines. Whether or not basalt will ever go head-to-head against other terroirs, like limestone or granite, in terms of noble status, remains to be seen. But if you're looking for examples of the quality basalt can produce, a few places have already distinguished themselves. Mount Etna. Are Etna wines as popular as winemakers there believe they are? Is it the hand of a marketer or promoter, or is there some truth to the hype? Those were my thoughts as Pascaline and I stared, mesmerized by the smoke plume that constantly puffs out from Mount Etna's mouth, which they call La Contessa. Just in case we thought about relaxing too much, La Contessa was a constant reminder that the volcano never sleeps and that she was the real boss of Mount Etna. The majestic Etna is screwed down on the northeastern part of the Italian island of Sicily, constantly belching and puffing. It's rich in mystique and mythology. The deadly monster Typhon, it is said, was buried deep within. According to Greek mythology, this was also the mountain where the Cyclops roamed and collaborated with the god's blacksmith Hephaestus to create Zeus's thunderbolts. With all of that godly history, no wonder there's so much ego on the mountain. But while ego speaks the loudest, the best work speaks humbly. Etna has only been bottling its wine instead of just making wine for immediate consumption for 20 years or so. Historically, they made their wines in palmentos, a series of old cement bath-like cisterns. Just as every country house in Georgia has their tiny Marani, the place dedicated to winemaking, almost all rural houses on Etna had a palmento. However, in 1991, the EU, in all of their determination to turn Europe into a soulless mall, outlawed these multi-level stone troughs where the grapes were stomped, supposedly because they're not sanitary enough. And so now, the new way is stainless steel, new wineries, and a loss of the very device that made the local vintage unique. So why is this little piece of heaven in Sicily in this book if the wines aren't completely formed yet? Because underneath it all, this place has climate, soil, and grape. The potential for brilliance is huge. The dirt. There was no better tour guide to the Etna dirt than viticulturist and winemaker Salvo Foti. He has been the keeper of the history and authenticity of Etna. We spent a day going to his vineyards, from the lowlands to his highest vineyards, 1,300 meters up, far higher than the region allows him to make a DOC, short-sighted of them. There, we stopped to chat to a neighbor who just pulled out some wild onions and greens from the ground for his dinner. The dirt is fertile and rich, but the basalt is also sandy. Fine sand, dry with very little, if any, clay, says Foti. And in that is yet another paradox of the soil. Fertile, but poor. That is what gives the wine its tension. To work the land there is difficult. Black basalt stones are plentiful. The big companies employ earth-moving machines to level the land and the soil. But among smaller farmers, painstakingly working the soil, often with hoes as if they were in a Bruegel painting, is common. Foti has been the major proponent of continuing to grow the vine in what is called alberello, where one vine is strapped to a single chestnut pole instead of strung on a wire in more conventional trellising. This also is tough. It takes 200 days per hectare to work this way, instead of 50, he says. But it's worth it because the grapes get even more nourishment from the plant, and thus the grapes ripen evenly on the vine. Through the vineyards we visited with him, we saw black volcanic ash similar to the kind I saw on the Canary Islands of La Palma and Lanzarote, where they call it picon. Several times a year, Etna spews forth a torrent of blue-black ash that covers cars, chimneys, and vineyards. It doesn't greatly affect the terroir, but it's a constant reminder that the volcano is no joke. Pumice also gets spat out of the caldera. These light, porous stones in black and gray, textured and airy as coral, are more relevant to the terroir. Pumice helps to absorb the water that falls on Etna, nourishing the vine. Meanwhile, Pascaline filled her pockets with dirt and rocks to take home. There's another trick to working the soils. A moat dug around each vine. Some people say this is Foti's idea, but Foti says he is just reviving an old way of farming. This helps to focus the rain that does fall down into the roots of the vines. He also believes that this enables the plant to better access the minerals in the soil. At the end of the trip, Pascaline tried to get through security with her 6-pound bag of rocks. Stopped by the guards, she begged them not to confiscate the stones. They looked at her as if she were a crazy person. "Why do you want these?" they asked. Thinking quickly, she said, "I just want to take something back home of your beautiful country." Winemaker profile. Vino Diana. Petite, spunky Anna Martins speaks fluent Italian with an Australian accent and is one of many newcomers to Mount Etna. Unlike many Etna winemakers who insist they're the best, she keeps a low profile and has her own way of exploring the wines of her area. It also helps that she was a winemaker in Italy and in Etna before she laid claim to the land. Martins was working in Italy when her husband Eric Nario, a wine importer based in London, came to Etna in search of a flavor he had tasted in a bottle of wine made on the volcano. I understand the draw. That wine was made not in a traditional Etna way, because Etna, until recently, made wine primarily for quick drinking, but in a traditional Italian way, where sometimes a bottle will be aged for up to 6 years before releasing. It translated the basalt soil as an ashy, lively wine with character. The impulse to follow a bottle often leads to a new chapter, and the couple decided to explore the territory. Anna started working as a winemaker for Andrea Franchetti's Passupisciato vineyard. Seeing the landscape crawling with gorgeous abandoned vines, like shelter kittens that needed adopting, they decided to make Etna their second home and started to collect an assortment of stunning vineyards. Nario took us to a truly special spot on the northern slope of the volcano. We stood high above where the eruption of 1981 came rushing down and ravaged the land. Up in Eric and Anna's newest vineyard, there was an alpine-like freshness. Pascaline and I stood there in awe with Eric during a spring when Etna was bursting with brilliant purple wild irises and cherry blossoms. Mount Etna looked like Mount Fuji. Looking down, we could see the lava that had frozen in its tracks after ravaging the vines. Only 30 years old, it needed centuries before it would degrade into soil. Standing in that vineyard with the meticulous terracing still intact, one could be intoxicated by the power of nature of the volcano. Looking down, mesmerized by the grazing animals below, Eric confessed that the real problem with Etna is conflict with the shepherds over who owns the land. Some of the stories of this clash rivaled those in The Godfather and included severed horse heads and terrible fires. Perhaps because they are not from Etna, Eric and Anna have more of a sense of freedom. Foti, who works on their viticulture, planted some Riesling and some Chenin, taking advantage of the higher elevation and the crisp volcanic air. But freedom has its own price. Flying between London and Etna with two small boys is not the easiest lifestyle. I asked Anna where her peripatetic energy came from. "It's kind of like a surfer in search of the perfect wave," she said. "The volcanic soils have an amazing energy. They're fertile and full of minerals such as copper, iron, and boric acid." Then there were the aesthetics. The tradition of vineyard cultivation with its dry stone-walled terraces and old alborello vines and all the native grapes. Much like a musician looks for a glorious instrument, a winemaker is looking for the perfect grape in which to translate the soil and place. Anna viewed Narello Mascalese, the region's prime red grape, as a wonderful vehicle to express the many nuances of Etna's terroir. Calabretta, a traditional winery located on Etna's north slope, uses a variety of botti, those big old barrels. But the couple chose a different method of winemaking, a type of Georgian amphora called caveveri. Having been given a present of two of these giant earthenware pots, she experimented. She liked what came out of them and ordered more. On the property, there was an old Cavevri she rehabbed and uses for one wine as an experiment. It's a lovely wine, very much like a vin de soif, wines for thirst. Just glug it back and have a good time. However, the bulk of her wines are a little more serious, even if they are made in clay pots. She hasn't totally abandoned wood and often uses a combination of barrels, some older, some larger, some Slovenian, and some smaller, but never adding a woody flavor to the wine. Her wines will join other vintages like Calabretta's Etna Rosso, the wine her husband came in search of, and Vini Certo, and take Etna to a place that people will revere. The grapes. Narello Mascalese was first bottled on its own here in Etna in 1985, but it took another decade for the wine's character to solidify. While it's now common, winemakers aren't quite sure how to make it or what to make of it. What it does have is structure and rasp with a core of blackberry. One quote that I think says it all is from grower Giuseppe Russo of Girolamo Russo. Nerello has a unique capacity to express the character of the soil it's growing in. Plant it anywhere else, and it loses its soul. There are a variety of ways on the island to discover its native reds. My five favorite producers use five different methods. Salvo Foti is reviving the art of making wine in the outlawed Palmentos after pleading the case for the tradition in the EU, arguing that it was the lifeline of the people on Mount Etna. He's set to work to resurrect the practice on his property and has just made Narello using foot stomping and open basins. After raising it in old oak and chestnut, Foti bottled what he refers to as his illegal wine. Frank Cornelison, who is rather obsessed with no outside flavors in his wine except grapes and terroir, destems, vinifies in fiberglass, then raises the wine up in epoxy-lined buried Spanish amphoras. He bottles it quickly, and the new vintages are usually bottled within 7 months. Anna Martins is another clay vessel devotee. The Calabretta winery vinifies as they do on the mainland with traditional ferments, raising in old oak and chestnut barrels of various sizes, and then up to 10 years of aging. And a very recent newcomer, Eduardo Torres Acosta from Tenerife, who is living in Sicily and making wine on Etna, brings a whole different approach. He takes his crop and combines three different vinifications, with stems, without stems, and crushed. Then the mixture goes into very old barrels. For white grapes, the one to watch is the salty Caricanti, an Etna Bianco high-acid grape with citrus overtones that can truly age beautifully. Salvo is retiring in Milo, which is the only commune allowed to label its Caricante as Etna Bianco Superiore, with its view of the eastern side of the mountain and the Ionian Sea. The soils there are super sandy, with plenty of the pumice they call ripido, stones from the sky. Volcanic soils are sandy soils, Foti said. There is virtually no clay in the soil. We tasted Foti's Caricanti Aurora in the vines and then later in his winery, just a few meters away from its origin. Whoa, it was a beauty. I believe in the wisdom of Foti, but was Etna the only place it could gain glory? When Pascaline and I had a chance to have a wine which came from the Caldera Contrada, the heart of Narello County where Foti had his old vines, I realized life existed for the grape elsewhere. The wine was made by a young couple, Giuseppe Certo and Valeria Franco, and at 6 years of age, it had developed into a salty melon of a wine with nerve. It was rooted in soils similar to Foti's vintages, but from a warmer spot, facing north instead of facing east and the sea. While all eyes are on Narello, we had to wonder, was Caricanti the real gem of Etna? Who to drink? I Vigneri, organic. Cantina Calabretta, organic. Vini Certo, organic. Frank Cornelison, organic. Vino di Anna, organic, biodynamic. Eduardo Torres Acosta, organic. The Canary Islands. Closer to Africa than its parent country, Spain, battered by the winds and eons of volcanic eruptions, this collection of seven islands in the middle of the Atlantic has stayed a secret until quite recently. All but one island make wine today, but if you believe Shakespeare and Kant, the Canary Islands were hot properties back in the 17th and 18th centuries. In fact, right up to 1797, when Lord Nelson lost his right arm and several hundred men on the Canary Island of Tenerife, it was the next best thing. But something happened over the next 200 years or so, and the islands went unnoticed, until a Spanish expat, U.S.-based importer Jose Pastor, discovered them, and the Canaries started their comeback. There were two aspects that attracted the various wine snobs to the area. One, in the late 19th century, a vine-sapping pest devoured much of Europe's grapevines. A grafting technique saved the industry, but left the fruit altered, and certain tastes were lost forever. Or so it was thought. It turns out the pest never infested the Canaries. The vines there, grown in volcanic soils, are a direct link to a distant winemaking past. 2. The volcanic basalt. The dirt. The most photogenic of the volcanic soils are those with the piquant, the black ash that squeaks like black snow, found on Lanzarote and La Palma. On Lanzarote, the vines are planted dramatically in huge round nests burrowed into pits in the ash to protect them from the strong African winds. On La Palma, the vines in the south are planted on the sides of volcanoes, even when old vines seem spindly in the poor soils. But Tenerife is the largest of all the islands, and even though there's no piquant, it's where most of the action is happening. Called the Land of Eternal Spring, Tenerife has the most varied climate and soils of the seven islands. Its dominating feature is one huge volcano, El Teide, the world's third tallest island volcano. On its north side, you feel as though you're in the wet and windy Loire region, while on the south side, it is as sunny and dry as if you're in the south of France. For a few miles, toward the top of El Teide, you notice how the once violent volcano created a never-ending moon landscape of hardened, jagged lava that looks like it will take another million years to weather into proper vineyard soils. Today, we have a region trying to become relevant. There has been pressure to modernize and to plant varieties like Cabernet and Merlot, but to follow that road would be foolish and disrespectful to the old vines of grapes more suited to the area. The man that will take the island to international acclaim is a visionary named Roberto Santana. Born in Tenerife with basalt in his blood, he gathered a group of friends from wine school and started a wine company called Envinate. They make wine throughout Spain, pinpointing lands that can express Atlantic characters. One of his first sites was the abandoned vineyard on the cliffs of Taganana, a tiny village located half an hour northeast of Santa Cruz, the biggest city on the island. In this place, there is iron-rich soil and black rocks left over from lava flows. Thankfully, it's been a long time since El Teide blew its top. Hopefully, Santana can continue bringing back the field blend of the vineyard from the almost wild vines and soil that turn the wines into liquid iron for a long time. The grapes. Most Canary Island grapes, the good ones, also grow all over Spain. For whites, the most prominent is Liston Blanco, also known as Palomino, the grape of sherry. It is relatively thin-skinned and low in acid, which makes for a quicker drinking and pleasant white wine. It is for sure in Roberto's parcel in Santa Cruz, and it blends well with a myriad of other grapes. It often tastes like a direct translation of the rugged sea air. Liston Negro is the primary red grape of the region and doesn't show up much elsewhere in the world. Herbal-tasting Negra Mol came to the Canaries from southwestern Spain. Malvasia is planted all over the Mediterranean, and it is famed for making sweet wine. The grape once had an exalted reputation in La Palma. Over the decades, it has been sacrificed, ripped out to plant banana plantations instead. Who to drink? Envinate, Taganon, Tenerife, organic. Dolores Cabrera, La Arancaria, Tenerife, organic. Borja Perez, Ignois, Tenerife, organic. Envinante Benji, Tenerife, organic. Fronton de Oro, Gran Canaria, organic. The Willamette Valley. Ah, so you love Oregon Pinot Noir. You like it better than California, less thick, less candied, but can't figure out why. Could it possibly be the place, the climate, the attitude, the soils? As it turns out, it's all of that. The dirt. Oregon's Willamette Valley is a 150-mile-long stretch from just above Portland down south, stopping just around Eugene. This is where the Pinot action in Oregon takes place. The climate is wet, with about 40 inches of rain a year. The growing season is long, yet unpredictable. Great stretches of hot and dry summer days are often thrown into the mix. Spend any time there talking to winemakers and you'll hear the term Jory. That's their soil. Colluvial sediments, a mixture of rock and fine sand sediments from cliffs and hills, plus a bunch of stuff thrown about by the Great Missoula floods, commingled with the main event, 15-million-year-old, deeply weathered basalt. Fly into PDX and you'll notice the volcanoes, Mount Hood and Mount Jefferson, out of the plane window. They are still considered active, but most of the volcanic soils come from the time before man, when this whole area was covered in water. Given all of that rain and sun, there's a lot of degradation, and the red soils of Jory are iron-rich and sandy, mixed with clay. If I had written this book about 6 years ago, I might have excluded Oregon because there were few makers that worked naturally and made wines I found exciting. On top of that, in one of the wettest growing areas in America, they tend to unnecessarily abuse the soil with irrigation. Why? I am forever dumbfounded. But more and more, there are those who are dry farming, meaning ditching the use of irrigation pipes. There are also more people working naturally. Today, I find Oregon one of the most exciting spots for interesting winemaking in this country, and much of it is on those hills of the Willamette Valley. One of the original standouts in the valley is Irie Vineyards, created by the founding father of Oregon wine country, David Lett. His winery, now run by his thoughtful son Jason, is still at the top of the heap. Jason is one of the best generational succession stories ever. I believe he and his father set the stage for the newcomers, even if they don't know it. Jason is intimately familiar with the land's history, noting that volcanic eruptions ladled out this soupy lava. It flowed across and over the top of continental shelf material and sediments. It created this layer cake of continental shelf basalt, marine sediment, and, on top of that, more soupy lava. You can see the layers in the soil. There are bookmarks in the way the colors change if you take a cross-section of soils. Each of these flows has a different chemical and physical composition. There are very few examples of Pinot Noir on basalt, other than the land between the Rhone and the Loire, the Auvergne, where, like Oregon, the wines tend more to layers of savory. I asked Jason if his dad had any angst about planting Pinot Noir in soil that was dramatically different than limestone, considering the golden rule for that grape. "No angst," he said. "Dad's whole thing, he didn't care about the chemical, he was more concerned with climate. He looked at some of the marine sedimentary soils, but those were sand and shales and unpredictable water-wise. He wanted more predictable. He wanted to grow without irrigation, and Jory really excels for that. Not all basalts are created equal." "The key," Jason says, "lies in the variation in the kind of clay that binds the soil together. There's a kind that swells when wet. You don't want that. It shrinks and cracks in dry weather and does not aerate." His dad realized that the clay in the Jory soils was kaolin, the kind that removes impurities from the skin and is often used in makeup. Unlike what some of the literature says, Lett believed that it is good for the vines. Instead of blowing up like a balloon, the clay swells in two directions in a series of flat sheets like planes of glass. That's why it's possible to walk in the wet vineyard without slipping on your butt. Also, when summers are dry, the microscopic bits of clay retain moisture. When David Lett was looking at climate, He was looking for a match for Pinot Noir. The Willamette weathers, not unlike Burgundy, though it has warmer winters and hotter summers. The second major consideration was the presence of slopes and hillsides. Only after those two factors were met did he narrow in on the soil. And what he needed was a soil that played well with the delicate Pinot vine. How water relates to the plant is super important. If you irrigate it and chemicalize it, you can lose it all by dislodging the vitality. The plant needs the whole community. Mineral exchange is vastly different in basic soils like limestone versus the acidic soils of basalt. In the end, Jason says, when it comes to wine, you're tasting a collaboration. The grapes. Oregon in general is known for Pinot Noir, but only in the Willamette Valley is it a given. With the proper intervention, you can make a California-style big Pinot in Oregon, but for the most part, the wines here have more savoriness and less solar-powered fruit. A number of other grapes do well here. Gamay will have a future. In the south, you're going to get a bunch of experiments from Syrah to Tempranillo. It's hotter down there, and the soil is different, so from Applegate vineyards, expect a sunnier wine. White grapes are abundant. Chardonnay? Sure. Iries is great and well-mannered. Melon de Bourgogne, the one which makes Muscadet and is usually found in the Loire Valley, is coming in strong in Oregon, where it shows more fruit than its Loire sister. Riesling does very well here, though with by no means the sophistication of the slopes and schist of the Mosel. The Columbia Gorge, an hour's ride from Portland, is producing some extremely interesting wines. I would give almost anything from there a chance. They are growing some impressive Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, and from what I hear, some damned interesting Mencia. Who to drink? Irie Vineyards, organic. Bow and Arrow, organic, biodynamic. Montanore, biodynamic. Monte Bruno, organic, biodynamic. Day Wines, organic, biodynamic. J.K. Carrier, organic, biodynamic. Minimus Wines, organic, biodynamic. Beckham Estate, organic, biodynamic. Cameron Winery, organic. Swick Wines, organic. Evening Land, biodynamic. Tuff. Somewhere in between basalt and granite is another form of igneous rock that comes from fire. Tuff. Because of its name, tuff is often confused with the limestone tuffeau. Listen to the terrain section in Chapter 2. However, it couldn't be more different. Tuff is an extrusive, blasted, fragmented lava rock, an amalgam of stuff from the volcano blast and silica-rich rhyolite, which ranges from a porous gray to a smooth, shiny glass. It shows up in Tuscany, but there's another very eccentric, exciting, and tuff-rich region worth talking about. Alto Piemonte. Long before I had any idea what volcanic soil was, I knew I was attracted to the wines of the Alto Piemonte. They grew a favorite of mine, Nebbiolo, even though they often called it a different name. The most important quality, though, was that the wines spoke of a place. The Alto Piemonte, also close to the Lake District, about an hour from the Milan airport, is the highest elevation zone in Piemonte, about 1,480 feet up. Once you get past the fashion outlets like Loro Piana, which have absorbed the dwindling vineyards, and into the vines, the air is bracing, and there's an element of starkness about it all. This part of the world has a clutch of tiny DOCs few care about, which is ludicrous. Among them are some beauties. Carema, Lisona, Fara, Gemi, Cisano, and a trio that's the most well-known, Gattinara, Bocca, Brama Terra. There are two DOCGs, Gemi and Gattinara. Red wine is chiefly made from Spana, the local name for Nebbiolo, responsible for the glorious Barolos in Piemonte. There are a few other supporting varieties. I've never seen a white from the area. The wines have this snappy, crunchy, alpine character, which means for the most part herbal notes and freshness come first in the taste profile. While in some years, some of the regions, like Lisona, can get jammy, for the most part, the wines have bony, not hedonistic, qualities. These are more like a good book, chock full of ideas and thoughts that makes you come back. The two regions I'm most drawn to are Bocca and Bramaterra. The dirt. The soils of both Bocca and Bramaterra are derived from a mixture of intrusive porphyry and extrusive igneous rock, lava, or tuff. The tuff, as mentioned before, is rich in silica and iron and contains larger crystals of quartz in a fine-grained matrix. The geological mystery here is something they call Valsesia, the supervolcano. Valsesia was active 280 million years ago and was only revealed when the African and European plates collided. After about 10 million years of eruptions, an even more surprising disaster happened. The volcano imploded. This created not only an enormous caldera, but three lakes as well, Orta, Maggiore, and Varese. Now, imagine what the hell would happen if El Teide or Mount Etna collapsed in on itself. Bocca was once perched on the tip of a volcano, but one would never know it from standing on the vines that grow on its remnants. In fact, when I visited one of my favorite producers from here, Valana, I had no idea of its explosive history. I used to drink gallons of Valana Spana when I was in my late 20s, and decades later, I finally got to go to the source. I asked the winemaker, Francis Fogarty, in charge of the family domain along with his sister Marina, to drive me into the tiny 22-acre DOC. Bocca occupies the highest elevation in the area. As we approached his land, all around me I saw odd-looking Maggiorina trellising. This is a sort of alberello, but they are not free-form. Instead, the vines are pulled upward in four directions, like tentacles hanging out to dry. It's a system that was developed in the 1700s and is quite rare, as it requires a lot of work. But on that visit to Valana, there were no vines. They'd been grubbed up, awaiting replanting. We arrived at a naked plot, isolated on an incline overlooking the huge monastery nearby. "See the different colored soils?" Fogarty asked, pointing to the veins of rose, red, and white dirt. He explained that the highly acidic porphyry soils, which are typically located a few kilometers underground, might be why the wines have an even longer life than the wines of Barolo, where the grapes grow on sediments. The soil in Bocca out-acids those of nearby Gemmi and Gattinara, perhaps the reason the DOC rules require the addition of other approved grapes to soften up the wine and add gentle aromatics. Another characteristic of the native soil, Fogarty explains, is that because the mother rock is so close to the soil, the roots actually manage to grow inside the little gaps in the rocks and almost fuse with the rock. He thinks this anchoring of the vines helps to prevent erosion and develops better fruit. On top of this, Bocca has a very complicated geomorphology, which provides for a very rich collection of microclimates in a comparatively small area. In Bocca, farmers have to deal with great variation in soil and microclimate conditions. Over on the other side of the Sesia River is the DOC Bramaterra. This is another tiny DOC, just 52 acres, though still about three times bigger than Bocca. There are plenty of differences between the two. Here, they call the grape Nebbiolo instead of Spana. Both Bramaterra and Bocca have porphyry soils, but in Bramaterra's soil, one can find the rock they call Porfido Tufaceo, which contains elements like silicon and boron, also found in the pumice of Etna, but partnered with a significant bed of limestone, which gives it a bit of a twist. Underground aquifers give the plant needed water during the driest seasons, but like Bocca, the problem here is too much rain, not too little. I met two of the DOC's finest growers, Antoniati and Mattia Odilio, and tasted their 2014s, which I thought were stunning, and even more surprising because it was a monsoon year in Italy and in most of Europe. Because of the rain, there was a lot of disease, such as mildew, and difficulty ripening the grapes, and when they ripened, there was mold. It just goes to show that a bad vintage usually simply indicates how much work there was to do in the vineyard. If you do the work, as the Odilios do, the wines can still be stellar. The Odilios explained that there is some limestone and clay in the region, but mostly it is grounded in porphyry, as in Boca. But in both Bramaterra and Boca, the porphyry is right at the top due to the ancient supervolcano eruption and is acidic and rich in iron. Both regions are capable of beauty, and yes, both regions are being pushed out by the fashion industry, the vineyards being replaced by outlet stores. It's depressing. How can a region capable of giving such gifts to the world be abandoned? If you're lucky, you'll get a drink of a Bramaterra wine and then go and compare it to a southern one using the same grapes, Nebbiolo, but raised in different soils, different climates, though just an hour's journey separates the two. Between the two large lakes, Orta and Maggiore, the weather-blocking capacity of the Alpine Mountains protects Alto Piemonte from extremes. The winters are cold and dry. Spring brings mild temperatures and rain. Summers are hot, and it stays that way through September. Then, during the October harvest, though this may change in the present warming global climate, the weather dips into cool nights. The grapes. This is Nebbiolo country, the same grape that gives you Barolo and Barbaresco. Here, however, the local name is Spana. Both Boca and Bramaterra also boast vines of Croatina, Vespolina, and Uva Rara. Vespolina is a sibling of Nebbiolo, and it's a delicate creature, prone to rot. It fell out of favor in the 19th century after a louse with the name of Phylloxera destroyed most of the vines of Europe. The cure turned out to be planting vines on American rootstock. However, there was a cost. Its taste. Famed British wine critic Chances Robinson writes in her book Wine Grapes that it failed to ripen well on its new feet, as rootstock is sometimes called. And so, a wine which originally gave so much sugar it attracted wasps is now somewhat subdued and is used in blends. Uva Rara is a very old grape in the area, and it brings a perfume to the mix. Croatina, called Bonarda in the Oltrepo Pavesi DOC, is the last piece of the puzzle. This grape might find its way into a 100% version, called a single varietal, but is generally best when added into the mix. Who to drink? Valana, Boca, sustainable and organic. Antoniati Odilio, Bramaterra, organic. Colombera and Garella, Lessona and Bramaterra, organic.